On this podcast, we discuss medical diagnoses and procedures. All of the guests express their own opinions. You should always seek medical advice from a trained and credentialed professional when making decisions about your own health. Welcome to the Sleep Apnea Stories podcast. I'm Emma Cooksey, and I've been coping with sleep apnea since childhood. I didn't know anyone in my life with a sleep disorder, so I decided to start this podcast. I'm here to build community and provide a platform for people with sleep apnea to tell their stories. Together, we can shatter stereotypes and raise awareness. We'll be exploring all sorts of treatment options and lifestyle choices to help you live your best life with sleep apnea. This is Sleep Apnea Stories, and I'm so glad you're here. Hey everyone, it's Emma Cooksey here, and I'm your host. So today is quite a controversial topic. So some of you might have seen that CBS News did an investigation into the AGGA oral appliance. So AGGA, A-G-G-A, which stands for Anterior Growth Guidance Appliance, is a fixed dental appliance. Dentists who are using this claim that it cures mild to moderate sleep apnea by growing the jaw forward. So it sort of falls into the same category as the Crozat or the ALF appliance. So you might have heard of some of those. So at the moment, there's a lawsuit for over 20 people suing the inventor of the AGGA, saying that it caused permanent damage, like they lost teeth and their teeth were pushed over like where their bones were and became unstable. And it's pretty grim. So I've linked the CBS investigation in the show notes. So you guys, if you haven't seen anything about this, you can go and watch it. But it's really heartbreaking to see some of these cases. And I really understand how it happens. Like, I feel as though as soon as this lawsuit was out there, you know, I saw dentists on LinkedIn saying, why would a patient ever, you know, like, go down the route of using an appliance that's not FDA approved for the treatment of sleep apnea? And the answer to that is because highly credentialed, experienced dental professionals are telling them that it treats sleep apnea, right? And there really isn't any peer-reviewed data to support that. So today I'm joined by Dr. Whitney Mostovitz-Levinson. And Dr. Whitney is a board-certified orthodontist in New York City. She's also an adjunct clinical assistant professor in the Department of Orthodontics at NYU. She's a Long Island native, and she studied human biology and visual arts at Brown University, and then dental school at Harvard School of Dental Medicine, which she graduated with honors. Then she completed her orthodontics residency at the historic University of Illinois at Chicago, where her research led to a master's degree. During her training, Dr. Whitney was fortunate to travel to Sydney, Australia twice to perform and publish award-winning research on obstructive sleep apnea and oral appliance therapy. This research was published in peer-reviewed journals like CHEST and the American Journal of Orthodontics and Dentofacial Orthopedics. So I'm so grateful to Dr. Whitney for taking on so many controversial topics, right? I think it's really easy in these situations to just kind of say nothing, but there's so much nuance to this discussion, like, that I really feel like it's going to be helpful to a lot of people. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Dr. Whitney Mostovitz-Levinson. Okay. So thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This is such an important, you know, conversation.
Yeah. So I first learned about you because I saw you do a webinar a few years ago about women and obstructive sleep apnea. And I was totally blown away. And I was like, wow, I have to have her on my podcast at some point. So here we are.
Amazing.
So recently, there was a CBS news story all about this case involving the AGGA, AGGA, fixed appliance that some dentists have been using to grow people's jaws, expand palates, that kind of thing. And so I feel as though these are the stories that, like, I've known about, but they've never really captured national news attention before. And I think it just highlights how much patients are struggling to navigate this whole palate expansion, whether that can help with sleep apnea, like which appliances are FDA approved, what they should do. So I'm hoping today we can just get your take on all of it and try and clear up some confusion and frustration among people. So
First.
let's dive in. So, do you want to start off by just explaining, like, I hear from people a lot who are working with, like, either an airway dentist or an orthodontist who is encouraging them to do, like, either an ALF appliance or Crozat or AGGA, all these different things. And when that story broke on CBS, there was a lot of posts, like especially on LinkedIn, I saw lots of dentists who were doing oral appliance therapy saying, oh my word, like, why would a patient go with an appliance that's not FDA approved for sleep apnea? And, you know, and I was kind of like, oh wow, yeah, because there's a whole bunch of people who are, you know, like professionals in dentistry and orthodontia who are recommending these. So I guess, can you just explain a little bit about this group of appliances, what we know about them? Like, is there a legitimate use for them that they're just being used off label as a sleep apnea appliance? Or just clear it all up for me as best you can. It's very complicated.
I mean, it really, opened up a really important conversation and awareness. So the AGGA I've heard about some also, in some I guess they're like Facebook pages, like sleep support or tongue tie groups, things like that. And I started hearing about these appliances, and I, as an orthodontist, actually never heard of them until like I joined some of these support groups and I looked them up. I went on their websites, and the part that was concerning to me was that there were no data supporting or evidence-based clinical trials in regards to these appliances. And I was like, I never learned them in my residency. I was kind of curious about them because I like to consider myself airway mindful. So the AGGA anterior growth guidance appliance, what that one does, it's fixed and it actually doesn't expand in the transverse. It moves in the what we call like AP dimension. So if you look at your face from a profile kind of forward. So if you saw in that CBS
So by
expose,
transverse, you mean outward,
transverse
like,
would be more outward, like the DNA appliance does expansion. This one does AP movement
so
and ALF
forward.
also some more forward movement. So if you saw in that expose the people that were showing pictures of their teeth flaring out, like there it was literally moving the teeth outside of the bony enclosure. Basically, there's a physiological and biological limit to how much our teeth can move, especially in non-growing adults. So I think that's the distinguishment that I think is important, that I think dentists in general, and probably even the founder of that appliance himself, I don't think they want to hurt people, knowingly. I think they truly think they're helping their patients. And I think what was lacking is that critical questioning of, wait, where's the data behind this? Where's the research and support? And I guess a big question goes back to that FDA approval question too, which I think CBS did a follow-up and asking that question, and they were able to, I guess, not need FDA approval because they claimed that their appliance wasn't moving things enough to warrant FDA approval, that it was such minor movements, although they claimed major
They
movements to
didn't
me.
look that
So
minor in, like, you know, in the court case pictures and stuff.
So I actually worked really hard at trying to find some unbiased literature on all of these appliances, and I found one study that came out in 2019, 22 that compared a lot of these appliances, and I could send you the name of that article.
I'd love that
Yeah,
one.
the tricky thing is the copy that I obtained is in French. So if you know anyone that's fluent in French, we can, translate. So, but what was interesting in this study, so they were comparing, I know I'm jumping ahead, like the
That's
Marfi,
fine.
which is, another expander
Yes.
using mini implants. And then they were looking at DNA, AGA, ALF, and I think they were comparing it to DOME, which have you heard of
Yes.
DOME, the
Yeah.
distraction osteogenesis? So that's more like I call it surgery light. Like it's not quite as
Yeah.
intense as a SARPI procedure. But it does involve visually opening the palatal suture. And in that study, I will note the sample size is small. I think it was 16 appliances that were non-surgical, and none of them showed on CBCT imaging actual opening of the mid-palatal suture. So they determined that all of the movements were tipping. So we'd call that dental movement. So
Moving
tipping the
teeth
teeth.
rather
Yeah,
than the actual
exactly. So it
structure of the
wasn't
jaw.
bony movement or skeletal movement. So it was really more just dental compensation. And it goes back to there's a limit to that. So maybe, in some patients that are being monitored carefully, you could stay within that physiological or biological limit and, not, create damage as shown in the CVS, examples, because
Yeah.
that was quite extensive movement. Like the
Yeah.
teeth were just kind of flapping in the wind, it almost looked like. So,
Yeah.
and I've seen personally a patient that went through one of these appliances as well with, I guess like holistic dentist, that kind of thing. And same thing, the front teeth were flared, the back teeth were pushed back, they were outside of the bony housing as well. And I referred her to a periodontist who I think determined that some of the teeth had to go. So it's, I think they promise also because of that AP movement that it will unlock the mandible, and then the mandible is going to jump forward and you don't need to do jaw advancement surgery.
Right.
So
Most people that I talk to who are considering these kind of, like, I think sometimes patients are, they're just in a difficult position, right?
yeah.
Because they're desperate to, most people are desperate to sleep.
Yes.
So they're kind of, and they're struggling with whether it's CPAP or an oral appliance or whatever they've tried. And so we get to the point where we're desperate for something that will help. And if one
Right.
of the these like dentist is saying like it just it kind of almost sounds too good to be true, but when you're in that situation you're more likely to think, well, if I can do that and it can help me, I won't have to have double jaw surgery, which
Right,
is extremely invasive and
exactly.
expensive and all of that. So I guess I just as a patient see it from that perspective that like I just feel for people, you know, like that are
Yeah.
in that situation.
So a little bit of a scary update. The CVS, report had in a follow-up report in March 15th that they found that the AGA is now under a new name being marketed as the osseorestoration appliance.
Okay,
So
how are you spelling it?
again, osseo is OSSEO dash restoration and
Okay.
then appliance.
So
So
that's the same thing as the AGA appliance that we talked about with the
yes,
lawsuit at the beginning.
exactly.
Okay. It's just a tough time to be a patient and navigate all this stuff.
But I think it's actually, it's great that they exposed this because now it forces patients as well as clinicians to
Yeah.
start asking, questions and being more critical, not just taking everything for face value or
Right.
trusting the guru that's selling this device.
Right.
So I think it's going to, lead to more evidence,
Yeah. I
and
hope
things.
so. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and I think studies are going to continue coming out. Because it's, I guess, the hot topic now. So, would you say?
Right. It was really good timing. I had a message last night from a mother of a teenager who was, I think, 17. And she said she was getting so frustrated because she had been to multiple different orthodontists and dentists. And she was being told by the dentist that her child could do the DNA appliance, which is a Vivos appliance, it's a
Right.
removable expander.
Yes.
So, which I know about because we can get into my whole thing in a minute. But she was saying, like, that dentist said, yes, your 17-year-old could do really well with this DNA appliance, which is removable. And then she was going to multiple orthodontists who were looking at her son and saying, no, because the palatal sutures starts to fuse later into the teen years and early adulthood. So they were recommending more of a surgical, like a Sarpy or Marpy or MSE, one of these things,
Right.
to actually surgically split open the palatal suture to get more expansion than they thought would be possible any other way. So can you, I feel like this whole thing is so like there's so many people saying different things
Yeah.
to patients, right? There's some people saying, you know, absolutely the palatal suture fuses and any, you know, like exactly what you just said, any movement would be the teeth and not a natural
Right.
proper expansion thing. And then there's other people saying that's old thinking, and as long as you know, they're pointing to the fact that it's living tissue, and even though, you know, they're just basically saying there is some movement is possible even in adults. So what is
Yeah.
your take on that?
So it's interesting you mentioned this because as I did a literature review, I did find some more recent studies have discovered that the palatal suture fuses later than previously thought. And really, the only way to, quantitatively know is taking imaging, like a CBCT, a 3D
Right.
scan, to see if the suture has fused. So previously and originally, we've, been taught and know that the palatal suture tends to fuse in the early adolescence. So let's say ages 12 to 14 in females, maybe a little bit later in males, so you can, see some older teens as candidates. So this study that came out, I think at this point is maybe 4 years ago, showed that there are some patients in their 20s, about almost 20%, still had open sutures. And I'd say 20%, it's a significant number. That's not 1%,
Right.
So, and males in general might have them open longer, just biologically speaking. So that can really determine what candidate of treatment. Obviously, a patient doesn't want to undergo an invasive Sarpy procedure if they, their suture's open and they don't
Right.
need surgery. So I think, doing the imaging, which is sometimes a required component for Marpy or MSE treatment planning anyway, so you could get the imaging, determine, the suture's open or it's starting
So
to
you can
close.
see that.
So of course, it depends on the detail of imaging. So different scanners have different definitions.
Yeah.
So I think, based on that study, like a clinician could, look at their methodology, what machines were used, and this is so new. So that's the
Right.
tricky part. That's why there's so
Yeah.
many opinions. So a lot of this is really cutting edge. Like some of these appliances, like MSE, Marpy, are, just a couple of years old
Yeah.
in terms of publications and data. So I think Marpy is maybe less than 10 years old. So, it takes years of gathering the data, and publications take, a few years before they come
Yeah.
out. So a lot of this news is, pretty cutting edge. I know that the American Association of Orthodontists is updating. In 2019, they also had what's called the white paper that was, I don't know if you've heard of
Yeah,
that
I
one, that
read that.
investigates sleep apnea. So they are updating it. So because everything, is changing so
Yeah.
rapidly. So I think that, I've surprised myself with older patients that palatal expanders, do open, and you'll see a midline diastema that's suggestive of
Yeah.
orthopedic movement. But again, there's always that trade-off. So the trade-off is how much true skeletal movement are we getting versus how much dental tipping and compensation are we getting. So in all these cases, they definitely need to be closely monitored. In terms of the DNA appliance, since I know that's a popular one and now I think was FDA approved. So I think with that one, the biggest trade-off also is time. So it's a removable appliance. Orthodontics ideally is slow continuous pressures that are constant, which is why, when I talk about tongue tongue thrust habits or that kind of thing, that to me is a orthodontic force. It's like constant
Yeah.
pressure. And that, I know I'm segueing a little bit, but we can talk about that too. But basically, the DNA, my concern with that one is that it's removable. So there's that compliance component. They say that you only need to wear it at night. So that's what we would call intermittent or interrupted orthodontic force. So that's just going to take longer. So I would, guess that it takes years before someone might even see like an actual difference. And then they probably, if they're an airway patient or have sleep disorder breathing, chances are that they also have a malocclusion and crowding, and their mouth is small, that's why you're expanding. So, if you're using that appliance for a couple of years and then you have another couple of years of orthodontics, it's just a long road of treatment before you actually see anything. And then that study came out showing that there was no orthopedic expansion anyway. So I think that
Yeah, like
maybe
so
mild treatment.
my like anybody listening to the podcast is going to be like, "We know," 'cause they've already listened to all the stuff. But just to fill you in, so I essentially would probably be a good candidate for MMA surgery, but I don't want to do that surgery.
That's fair.
And I'm also on CPAP and it's not perfect, but it's, keeping my AHI low and all the things. So I don't think I'm one of those people. I know people who are looking into these things because they can't find a treatment that's effective at all for them. So I'm in
Right.
a different situation, but I certainly had all the, things that would make me a good candidate for some sort of palatal expansion, just because I have all the classic, like high, really arched palate, like super narrow. All the things. And so essentially, like, I signed up to do the VBOS thing. There was a dentist that I actually knew who had just trained in it. So that's kind of a red flag. You might want someone that knows, about sleep apnea. But so I basically did a DNA appliance for, I think, 9 months. And then after that, did an mRNA appliance, which is also got a mandibular advancement device attachment. So they're both expanders, but the DNA one, like the mRNA one, had FDA approval because they looked at the fact that it was a mandibular advancement device. So they
Right.
weren't actually saying to the FDA, this appliance, like, we're applying to say because of the palate expansion it treats sleep apnea. They
Okay.
were essentially piggybacking on
Validating.
the fact that it was a mandibular advancement device. So that was the one I did second. I did the DNA first, and my experience, so I was wearing it just like you said. I was doing about 15 hours every 24 hours, and I went for 15 months, and I did see, like, what you're talking about, like a gap between my two front teeth and tiny, tiny movements. But it didn't help my sleep apnea. So I kind of, and also the other thing that was kind of like the final straw for me was my teeth at the front did start protruding forward more than I was comfortable with, and I just abandoned it at that point. So for me, it didn't work, and then I didn't do any sort of I didn't do like a retainer or anything. So there wasn't any permanent, like, as soon as I stopped wearing those
Everything went back.
appliances, everything, you can see went back to where it was before, right? But I know so many people, like, I'm in all the communities and I've made lots of friends. Like, I know it's really weird, but like all of
Oh, that's
the
great.
patients trying to figure this out kind of like stick together. And there are people who are exactly what you said, like doing a very long term. Like, I know people that have been using these kind of appliances for like 2 years. And they're gradually seeing an improvement in their sleep apnea. Like, their sleep studies are showing like a lower AHI and they're starting to feel a bit better and all that. So I think that the thing I would say to people listening is that it's not like you can tell me exactly what you think about it, but it's not so much that I think that it can never work.
Right.
I just think we don't know, like, how people are so different in their background and their, physiology and
Yes.
like their anatomy. And I don't think we have enough data to show this reliably treat sleep apnea, in most people. It's like, they've kind of,
Well, actually, I don't know if there really is any data.
no, there's
So
not. I
that
mean,
was
like, what was,
my
so I don't
concern.
know if you can kind of explain to people, but from what I read, how the DNA was given FDA clearance was patient, almost like case studies, like, so that they kind of followed a certain number of patients and were able to show in those individual cases that they'd improved their sleep apnea. Am I
Yeah,
understanding that right? Maybe not.
so that was one, thing that troubled me when looking up that appliance. There are some studies, however, they're done in-house. I'm probably saying
Right.
things that are really controversial right now.
I know this
But
whole thing is really controversial, but patients are
so
just really struggling with it because they
yeah.
can't, navigate through it.
Like if
So.
you look closely, some of the published studies had sample size of one, so it's like a single case report. So yes, you might find success in one patient, but and they were done, like if you look at the authors, the main author or one of the authors is the person who founded the appliance. So this
Right.
isn't, an unbiased study,
Right.
by
And it's
design.
not, I think people, just average patients, don't really think much about it. But if things like peer-reviewed studies are really like the standard, right? That
Right,
it's
exactly.
actually been reviewed
Right.
on
So
in an unbiased
that's
way.
exactly like kind of the nuance I'm getting at. So the literature that's out there is maybe not high tier or high quality literature. And then another thing that concerned me is I browsed some websites and they all show the same cases, like same pictures, before and after of the airway changes. And I was like, so these aren't your personal cases. So that kind of concerned me when people on their websites, when they're trying to explain an appliance, show some generic image that is probably from the company. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I
So
do. So I think with all of this, from a patient perspective, it's really difficult because it's not like going, to somebody who doesn't have an interest in you signing up to do the treatment. So it's really hard. It's not that, I mean, and I think that, the dentist I went to, I think, is a really good dentist and really ethical. But it just is one of those things where you really don't, you're in a position where you're being marketed to.
yeah.
So that makes it really hard. So the next thing was, oh yeah, what I really want to talk to you as well about is how orthodontics are kind of evolving. Like, I feel like back in the day, like, it was very common for people to have like teeth extracted and pretty retractive braces, and
Yeah, so
it
I'm happy to
feels,
tell you a little
yeah.
background history.
So talk me through all
So
that.
Originally, orthodontics, was generally a non-extraction treatment. And this one orthodontist that started working in the, turn of the mid-20th century, Dr. Tweed, have you heard of that guy?
Yeah.
So he,
But for
tried to
people
follow.
listening who are
So
like,
he was
what,
an
do explain.
orthodontist that was, pretty prominent and was trying to create, balanced occlusions and, was looking at what he called facial balance or
So the
certain
occlusion
beauty
is the
standards.
bite, right?
And then he was looking at soft tissue, particularly orthodontists like to look at the face from a profile view, looking at,
Yes.
soft tissue and the nose and where the lips and the chin meet. And he just was having trouble having, what he called a balanced result. And he ended up extracting four first premolars, and he did several cases with those extractions, was able to retract the teeth that he thought were flaring, so they're more upright and inside the bone. Particularly, he would do a measurement looking at the angle of the mandible, and then the lower incisors would be a certain position to have a favorable, or what he called aesthetic facial profile. So
Right.
that's where orthodontic extraction treatment, became a thing. And another principle that he had was called anchorage. So to really prevent anything or anterior movement, he wanted to hold back the jaws. And that's, again, where headgear came in, which was
Right.
extra facial Anchorage. So that appliance
You're
really
talking about
messed with
headgear pushing things back almost.
or not that it pulls back, it's that it's restraining growth. So a
Okay.
headgear creates like a posterior force and it restrains the skeletal growth. So that's used a lot in what we call like class two malocclusions, where the upper jaw is more forward. Although in a lot of those cases, it might be that the upper jaw is actually small and the lower jaw is really small. So it's always like a relative relationship. But that's kind of where retractive, we could call it, orthodontics kind of developed. And that was really in like the 1960s or so. And they had literally, you'd place like a line from the nose to the chin and look at where the lips are. Like there were certain proportions and the angles of the teeth. And that, I guess, we could call another trade-off. So sometimes non-extraction orthodontics leads to what we call camouflaging or dental compensation. And the teeth might look a little flared. And some people, you know, today's world, some people are paying a lot of money to have fuller lips and, you know, fuller features, but people don't like it. Or even, I guess, you know, trends have changed, or even ideologies or perceptions of what is beautiful have changed. And, you know, in the 70s, 80s, so forth, a lot of extractions were done. And then as we saw those patients age, there were some unfavorable facial changes. So the teeth had, you know, less support on the lips. So some people would say that as people age, they looked more like a witch, even. These are
Or kind
just
of
strange
sunken
terms.
in
Yeah,
almost.
exactly. Sunken in, and then the nose and the chin look big relative to the lip or the lower face because everything's pulled in. So some people then started noticing what we would call unfavorable facial changes. So then there were, you know, philosophies like, oh, we can open up those extraction spaces and reopen, you know, everything. And I guess that goes to, I know you initially mentioned Dr. Hang and, you know,
Yeah,
Bocelli
so
extraction.
Dr. Hang kind of coined this term extraction retraction regret syndrome because he was
Right.
seeing a lot of those patients who were feeling that there was this link between having had these premolar extractions and retractive braces and usually headgear too, and like how well they were breathing later. So this is kind of where the sleep apnea part of it comes in. And I know, and so one of the reasons it's so controversial is that there's a lot of things that go into sleep apnea, right? Like I definitely had, I actually only had two, I had the upper premolars removed and then braces, and I didn't have headgear. But also going into that, it's worth saying I was a mouth breather since, you know, I was a baby, and I had horrendous allergies and just thumb sucker,
The works.
really poor. I just had everything not going for me. So I think that in this kind of debate, I think that you meet a lot of patients who say, you know, that they really notice that the extractions and the braces, you know, like they almost felt like they were fine before, and then this happened to them, and then they had the negative outcomes. Whereas I don't really feel like I'm in that camp. I feel like it was almost like the cherry on top of
So that's what I think is tricky with the extraction, non-extraction debate. It's not like we want to say extractions cause sleep apnea. There's no way to truly prove that. It's
No, there
probably that
isn't.
that patient already had risk factors, and that's probably why they also had so much crowding, because they didn't have enough, you know, skeletal growth because of maybe lack of tongue pressures during the formative years. And we could talk about that too. So these patients had severe
That's my
crowding,
favorite
and
subject.
it's really so it's more like they had a lot of crowding, they had the teeth pulled out, but why? Why did they have a lot of crowding? And why was that done? And so I think what was missing is looking at those risk factors at a younger age, because sleep apnea is also, I like to call it, a disease of aging. So, you know, you might not see it in younger years, and then 20s, 30s creep up, and then you start noticing, oh, I feel a little tired. And then, you know, downstream another 20, 30 years, that's when you start having hypertension or diabetes or other medical, you know, conditions that, if, you know, we caught the sleep apnea early on, maybe we could have prevented.
This episode of Sleep Apnea Stories is sponsored by BetterHelp. How well we look after our mind really affects how we experience life. Therapy has been so helpful to me since I was diagnosed with sleep apnea. It helped me to work through the feelings I had about going undiagnosed for so long. It also helped me to adjust to living with a chronic condition. One of the best things about starting my podcast has been realizing I'm not alone in coping with mental health issues along with sleep apnea. Speaking to a professional therapist has helped me enormously to manage my anxiety and depression. BetterHelp is online therapy and it's much more affordable than in-person sessions. You can get matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/Emma. That's betterhelp.com/Emma.
I think, you know, looking at some things from a really young age can, you know, be preventative. And I think that's also where orthodontics comes in from a world of prevention. So
right.
I don't think one treatment or the lack of one treatment can necessarily definitively cause, because as we discuss sleep apnea, I like to call it very multifactorial, four-dimensional, because there's anatomy, there's collapsibility of the airway, then there's the brain. So some people have sleep apnea and it's not even anatomic, it's just, you know, just nervous system related. So there's just so, and then posture, even sleeping posture, there's just so many contributors that, you know, can lead to sleep apnea. So it's hard to, you know, pick one thing, like, oh, the extractions are what did it. So,
right,
you know, like you said, it's the cherry on top. Like, I think it's like a whole constellation of certain signs and symptoms that I think in, you know, these recent years have become more and more, you know, clinicians are more and more aware and they're asking the right questions. Or, you know, I don't know if every dentist or even primary care physician is checking the airway, you know, or that's, I think, another.
That's what we need. For sure.
Yeah, I think that's another tricky thing too. Like in my own personal example, like I had a daughter, I guess almost a year and a half ago, and they were like, oh, she's like, I saw a tongue tie. I'm like, oh, there's a giant tongue tie there and a lip tie. I was like looking at them. And then the doctor in the hospital, no, you're wrong. The primary care when I went outpatient was like, no, there's no tongue tie. But I knew there was one. So I got it released. And I think it really needs to start that early. Like, because if you don't address the tongue and the tongue lacks mobility, then how are we going to have growth in the air or the oral cavity, really?
But I also wonder what you think to this idea of orthodontics starting a bit earlier, because I know like most dentists are kind of saying like, you know, take them for a consult when they're 12. Unless they have something really crazy going on. Do you think we just need to look at starting a lot earlier, like especially for the kids that don't seem to have enough room?
Right. So actually, like our, at least our guidelines or the American Association of Orthodontic Guidelines are to start, you know, as young as 6 or 7 with just an initial evaluation. It doesn't mean we're doing treatment, but we're looking for risk factors. And I am, you know, a strong supporter of what we call like phase 1 or interventional or interceptive, you know, it's my term. Orthodontics. And, you know, you're not doing a full set of braces, but a lot of times that could be a palatal expander and a limited set of braces to align things. Or some people have severe crowding and they need to do an intervention to get some even baby teeth in. So I do think there is an important place for early treatment. And, you know, it's not for every orthodontist. So there's some orthodontists that do want to wait until all the adult teeth are in before they treat. But that doesn't mean that's all orthodontists. So I think finding, you know, orthodontists that have that mindset, there's some offices that treat as young as 3 years old with an expander. So I think case selection is also important. Not every 3-year-old tolerates a palatal expander. It's ready, but I do think that there are, really initial airway evaluations, and there's a lot of kids that are, let's say, misdiagnosed with sleep, not sleep, ADHD,
Right.
a lot of behavioral consequences or developmental delays, moodiness or headaches, like
Yeah.
obesity. So there are, other symptoms that, or, diagnoses we might give to kids, and then there's an underlying airway disorder. And I think people are and becoming more and more aware of this. So
Yeah. I
this
really
is just
think it's what
important.
you said, going back to what you said earlier, is so true. Like, I would love to see, right, what from when a kid's born, like all of the pediatric dentists and pediatricians looking for some of these signs, like mouth breathing and just that their jaws, there's so many things they could do early, I think. What do you think about myofunctional therapy and like teaching kids to breathe through their nose and keep their lips
So
closed and that kind of
that's
thing?
like another, I end up referring a lot to myofunctional therapists, whether patients will go or not, and adhere to it. That's
Yeah.
another story. But I
Especially
advocate.
young children. That's kind of the thing. It's like,
Yeah,
yeah.
so and I joke, I'm like, maybe I see like a higher proportion of patients with tongue ties, or not necessarily tongue, restrictive movement of their tongue.
Yeah.
Or so I could give you my little mantra on what I like to tell people to do. And in a lot of my consults, I always offer a piece of mouth tape. I don't know, you've probably heard of mouth tape.
Yeah. I interviewed
Usually,
James Nestor, so like we talked all about
amazing.
that. Yeah.
So I like to talk a little bit about, how our resting posture, like physiologically, should be. If your teeth are together, that's paradoxical. That's considered clenching or grinding, and
Yeah.
grinding will be a sign of, a blocked airway. So teeth should be ideally apart, lips are sealed together, and that also helps ensure nasal breathing. And I like to have the tongue resting, I call it like the N position. So if you mentally say the letter N and your tongue is resting on the palate, that's, a more physiological position versus resting on the front teeth, which a lot of people with a tongue thrust or open bite or
Yep.
flared teeth, that seems to be a more popular resting position. And a lot of those patients that have an open bite or a tongue thrust often have a restricted tongue. And, it's one of those chicken or egg scenarios where it's like, what caused what? But,
Yeah.
in those growing young, really young growing ages, they, develop this growth pattern, the high vaulted narrow palate, and then it contributes to mouth breathing, which leads to more inflammation in the airway. So it all kind of,
Yeah,
it's a deadly cycle
snowballs.
almost. Exactly. So I try, and some patients have trouble. They put their tongue up on the roof of their mouth and they're like, ooh, this is not easy. Like one study notes up to 4% of kids can have, these sleep concerns, and I'm guessing that number is actually a low estimate. It's probably higher.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of parents even need to be aware if their kid's snoring at all, that's already a red flag.
Yeah.
Like, because some parents are like, oh, I'm so cute, my kid's snoring, and it's like, no, it's not cute. Like
Not cute.
that's a stress response in the body. So
Yeah.
another interesting fact is, bedwetting is another risk factor of sleep disorder breathing that
Yeah.
people aren't always aware of. And I always like to explain the physiology why, and it's like kind of scary and interesting at the same
Oh, I
time.
really want to know.
So basically, a bladder control, it's important, but it's not vital for survival. So in, a sleep disordered breathing episode or apnea episode, we kind of, our sympathetic nervous system goes into drive, and that's our fight flight response. And we're really fighting for life in those, or oxygen in those examples.
Yeah.
And in those cases, the body determines holding bladder control is not important. So that's why a lot of those people will, release. Or if you think of examples when people are scared and they pee themselves, or they're in an
Yeah.
accident or some violent situation, and they, have an, because again, it's that they lose the body's, in that fight flight mode. It's like, what do I need to do right now to survive?
And
And holding your bladder is not that.
if you think about your child, like that is not how you want them to be sleeping. They're supposed to be relaxed and rest and digest, not like ready to run from a bear.
So that's what's scary, especially, you have AHIs that are, 34. Like this is happening many times throughout the night, that
Yeah.
and that's what leads to, hypertension down the road. Like these
Yeah.
spikes, definitely, how you feel too. So a lot of these patients definitely feel foggy or tired, not feeling as upbeat or fast. And that's what I think is interesting too. I think so many, especially adult patients, like that's just their baseline. Like they don't know otherwise how they could feel. Like once they have treatment, it's like, oh, I could have felt like my whole life like this way, you know?
I know.
So I think it's
Makes a huge
tricky.
difference for sure.
But I do think, even oral appliances or CPAP, there can be dental side effects too. And I think that's, from an orthodontic perspective, a conundrum. And I'm like, well, because I don't know if you've heard how long-term you could develop more class three kind of
Yeah.
relationship.
So
So
you're
that.
talking about with an oral appliance, because it's moving your lower jaw forward, it can affect the way that
Yeah.
your teeth,
I can.
like.
And but to me, because I've had some orthodontists say, but you're an orthodontist, like why, like how can you accept that? And it's like, well, they're alive, they're healthy, they feel better, like there's a trade-off. I mean, like me, a lot of times you joke, like you don't die from a crossbite, but or like patients that have an open bite and they're well nourished, like you can still eat and function, but if you have airway occlusion like throughout
I
the
think
night.
people underestimate just the health impacts of untreated sleep apnea. Like,
Right.
it's really serious. And so it is that trade-off where, like, I've read a little bit about some of the things that happen to people's bite long term if they're using oral appliances, like, but also, like, if you're getting restful sleep and you're not at that higher risk for a stroke and heart attack and all those
Right.
other things, I just tend to look more at the bigger picture for your overall
Exactly.
health.
Yeah, exactly. That's I think that, like there's a trade-off, but I think in the grander scheme of one's whole life, I think it's worth it, you know? So.
So I did want to ask you a little bit about pregnant women,
Sure.
because I feel as though I've done a couple of episodes on sleep apnea and pregnancy, but I feel like we need a ton more research. But for me, like, there's not enough attention being paid to that, because I feel as though a lot of women I talk to are going to their OBGYN. And the OBGYN obviously has a lot to cover during that time, like in their 10 minutes or whatever they get.
Or 5 minutes.
They're complaining of, yeah, exactly, like 6 minutes actually in the room. And so the woman's like complaining of daytime sleepiness and all different symptoms of sleep apnea. But there's this difficult thing where women often don't sleep as well during pregnancy. So it's like the doctor's kind of saying, oh, that sounds quite normal for pregnancy,
Right.
but actually the woman has sleep apnea. So do we need to do a better job of screening for sleep apnea during pregnancy? Like, what's your take on it?
Yeah, no, that's actually a good point. I know a few years ago, I think when I was pregnant, I did a lit review, and there were studies that showed that there is an increased risk of sleep apnea during pregnancy.
Yes.
And it often goes hand in hand with the same patients that are at an elevated risk for diabetes as well.
Yeah.
So I do think that there needs to be more maybe education or communication or cross communication. I think that's missing a lot in healthcare,
Yeah.
especially sleep
Oh,
is
for
such
sure.
a
I
multifaceted
feel as though
industry.
sleep and sleep apnea particularly is just so, like, desperate for people to talk to each other, because it's like you're going to the OBGYN because you're pregnant, so they know a ton about that. But I
Right.
feel like just at least some education about this increased risk of sleep apnea could really help spot a lot of
Yes.
people.
Yes. So that is true. There is a higher risk. I don't know how aware OBs are of that data, but studies
Yeah.
have come out and it is important. I think screening is definitely an important tool, but it is and it's funny because maybe that is part of the big reason why like pregnancy is associated with poor sleep. Maybe that's like
Right.
behind the scenes and we need to like
Yeah.
bring it up front.
Yeah.
So it is a good distinction that, I have a feeling that OBs are not communicating a ton with the sleep,
Yeah.
world.
And I mean, I'm always like really cognizant of, like all the doctors have, like, I know that they can't be an expert in every single thing, but I just think especially pregnancy and also menopause, I think there's a lot of women going undiagnosed with sleep apnea that, have all the symptoms, but it seems like those phases, they're kind of like, up until this point, we've just kind of said, oh, there's sleep problems with that's normal, and it makes me
Well, that's,
worry
I
about
think,
the number
what
of people.
the shift needs to be. Like, even starting from the beginning, like, oh, it's so cute that they're snoring, or people
Yeah.
still find snoring cute. And I'm like, what?
It's
Like, even in
not cute.
adults, and I'm just like, this is, I think that
Yeah.
mindset needs to shift where, if there's poor or disrupted sleep, that means something, versus
Yeah.
like just accepting it as a baseline.
Right. Yeah, it's not great.
I think over time it's going to shift it. Another fun factoid, the American Board of Orthodontics used to require an extraction case for becoming board certified. And a few years ago,
Oh.
they actually removed that requirement.
I
So I
didn't
think
know
the
that.
pendulum's swinging. So hopefully that's like a glimmer of good news. I think the pendulum's swinging. I think
Yeah.
people are becoming aware of these things. So, it takes time, but
It does take time.
I think it's coming to light though. So I think
Yeah.
the mindset will continue to shift.
That's awesome. So for to wrap up, I think what you're saying is, would you say that your take is only go with FDA approved appliances? Would that be
So,
fair?
I wouldn't even, I wouldn't necessarily say FDA, because as you saw, like, they're, submitting to FDA approval for one thing, but then in clinical use, they're using it for something else.
Right.
So I would say to only use appliances that there's evidence-based data behind.
Right.
So
That's a really important
I think
difference.
asking those questions and, seeing the studies, seeing cases that are not just from a generic website that the company is providing
Right.
clinicians. So I think showing that there's real work and not sample sizes of one in a study, like real studies, And again, this is
So
going to
when
take
you're
time.
saying real studies, you're talking about peer-reviewed and in a journal of like I don't even know what the orthodontic or
There's a
dental journals
few.
are, but
And I guess that's tricky too, because, a lot of these are novel techniques. So there won't
right.
necessarily be those studies yet. So I think there's going to have to be, some trust as well. And,
Yeah.
I think asking questions like, why are you doing this? And, what's, looking at past research to, give rationale for why current methods are being utilized. But I think, yeah, it's not a, black and white answer. So there does
Right.
have to be that element of trust as well. And I do think most dentists and orthodontists mean well, and they want to help their
Definitely.
patients. So I
Yeah.
think, yeah,
It just
it's
feel
tricky.
it, it feels as a patient a little bit like the Wild West at the moment.
I can
Like it just
understand
maybe
that.
is this period where until lots more we have lots more, cases and evidence, it's just going to be really
Exactly.
difficult for patients to navigate. But
And
I
I think,
appreciate you
yeah.
helping us today and actually
Yeah,
explaining
thank
some of the
you
stuff.
for having me. And I'm gonna,
Absolutely.
also put everything that we discussed into paper, and I'll be a lot more detailed, so that could be a useful resource as well.
That would be awesome. Yeah, I think you should definitely do that. Thank you so much for your time. Thanks so much for listening. I love hearing from you. If you'd like to be featured in an upcoming episode, please email me at sleepapneastories@gmail.com. That's also the place to get in touch if you just want to say hi or ask a question. Alternatively, you can always reach me on Instagram. My handle there is @sleepapneastories. If you're enjoying the podcast, please subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen. This really helps a wider audience to find the episodes, and I really appreciate it.